Ivory, as the last Krondorian soldiers departed for the north. Rumour had it Guy would also send the garrison at Chamata to the front once the fighting with Kesh had been settled, leaving every garrison in the principality manned by soldiers loyal to Bas Tyra. Arutha spent most of his time in taverns, places of business, and the open markets most likely to be frequented by those from the palace. Amos prowled near the docks or in the city's seedier sections, especially the infamous poor quarter, and began making discreet inquiries about the availability of ships. Martin used his guise as a simple woodsman to blunder into any place that looked promising. Nearly a week went by this way, with little new information being unearthed. Then, late the sixth day after Guy had quit the city, Arutha found himself being hailed in the middle of the busy square by Martin.
"Arthur!"
shouted the hunter as he ran up to Arutha.
"Best come quickly."
He set off toward the waterfront and the sailor's ease. Back at the inn, they found Amos already in the room, resting upon his pallet before his nightly sojourn into the poor quarter. Once the door was closed, Martin said, "I think they may know Arutha's in Krondor." Amos bolted upright as Arutha said,
"What? How?"
"I wandered into a tavern near the barracks, just before the midday meal. With the army gone from the city, there was little business. One man did enter just as I was readying to leave. A scribe with the city's quartermaster, he was fit to burst with a rumour and in need of someone to tell it to. So, with the aid of some wine, I obliged him by playing the simple woodsy, and by showing respect for so important a personage. Three things this man told me. Lord Dulanic has disappeared from Krondor, gone the night Guy left. There's some business of his having retired to nameless estates to the north, now that Guy's viceroy. But the scribe thought that unlikely. The second thing was news of Lord Barry's death." Arutha's face showed shock.
"The prince's Lord Admiral dead?"
"This man told me Barry had died under mysterious circumstances, though there's no official announcement planned. Some eastern lord, Jessup, has been given command of the Krondorian fleet."
"Jessup is Guy's man," said Arutha. "He commanded the Bas Tyra squadrons of the king's fleet."
"And lastly, the man made a display of knowing some secret concerning a search for someone he only called the Viceroy's royal cousin." Amos swore.
"I don't know how, but someone's marked you. With Erland and his family virtual captives in the palace, there's hardly a chance another royal cousin's come wandering into Krondor in the last few days, unless you've a few out and about you've not told us of."
Arutha ignored Amos's feeble humour. In the span of time it took for Longbow to tell his tale, all his plans for aiding Cridy were dashed. The city was firmly in control of those either loyal to Guy or indifferent to who ruled in the king's name. There was no one in the city he could turn to for help, and his failure in bringing aid home was a bitter thing. Quietly, he said, "Then there's no other course but to return to Cridy as soon as possible."
"That may not be so easy," said Amos. "There's more strange things occurring. I've been in places where a man can usually make contact with those needed for a dishonest task or two, but everywhere I've made inquiries, discreet, have no doubt, I come up against only hard silence. If I didn't know better, I'd swear the upright man's closed up shop and all the mockers are now serving in Guy's army. I've never seen such a collection of dumb barmen, ignorant whores, uninformed beggars, and tongueless gamblers. You don't need to be a genius to see the words gone out. No one is to talk to strangers, no matter how promising a transaction's being offered. So we can look for no aid in getting free of the city. And if Guy's agents know you're in Krondor, There'll be no lifting of the blockade or opening of the gates until you've been found, no matter how loudly the merchants scream.
We're deep in the snare, agreed Martin. But if Guy's men only suspect I'm in Krondor, they may tire of the search.
True, agreed Amos. And after a while, the mockers may open up as well. Should they agree to help, for a significant price, you can be certain, we'll have powerful help in leaving the city.
Arutha balled his fist and struck the pallet upon which he sat. Damn Bastyra! I'd gladly murder him this instant. Not only does he imperil the West, he risks a greater schism between the two realms by taking the principality under his own banner. Should anything happen to Erland and his family, it's almost certainly civil war.
Amos slowly shook his head.
A bollocksed mission, this, and through no fault of yours, Arutha.
He sighed.
Still, we can't be startled into panic. Friend Martin may have misunderstood the scribe's last remark, or the man may have been speaking simply to hear himself talk. We'll have to be cautious, but we can't bolt and run. Should you vanish from sight completely, someone might take notice. Best if you stay close to the inn, but act as you have been for the time being. I'll continue to make attempts at reaching someone who may have ways to get us clear of the city. Smugglers, if not the mockers.
Arutha rose from the pallet and said, I've no appetite, but we've eaten together in the common room every night. I expect we'd best go down for supper soon.
Amos waved him back to his bed.
Stay a while longer. I'm going to run down to the docks and visit the ship. If Martin's scribe was not just breaking wind, they'll certainly search the ships in the harbour. I'd better warn Vasco and the crew to be ready to go over the side if necessary and find some place to store your chest. We aren't due to be hauled out for refitting for another week, so we must act with care. I've run blockades before. I wouldn't want to risk it in a hulk as leaky as the Wind of Dawn. But if I can't find another ship...
At the door, he turned back to face Arutha and Martin.
It's a black storm, boys, but we've weathered worse.
Arutha and Martin sat quietly as Amos entered the common room. The seaman pulled out a chair and called for ale and a meal. Once he was served, he said,
Everything is taken care of. Your chest is safe as long as the ship is left moored.
Where did you hide it?
It's snugly wrapped in oilcloth and tied securely to the anchor.
Arutha looked impressed. Underwater?
You can buy new clothes, and gold and gems don't rust.
Martin said, How are the men?
Grumbling over being in port another week and still aboard ship. But they're good lads.
The door to the inn opened, and six men entered. Five took chairs near the door while one stood surveying the room. Amos hissed.
See that rat-faced fellow who just sat down? He's one of the boys who've been watching the docks for the last week. Looks like I've been followed.
The man who remained standing spotted Amos and approached the table. He was a plain-looking man, of open countenance. His reddish-blonde hair was flyaway around his head, and he wore a common sailor's clothing. He clutched a wool cap in hand as he smiled at them. Amos nodded, and the man said,
If you're the master of the Wind of Dawn, I'd have words with you.
Amos raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. He indicated the free chair, and the man sat.
Name's Radburn. I'm looking for a berth, Captain.
Amos looked about, seeing Radburn's companions were pretending not to notice what was transpiring at the table.
Why my ship?
I've tried others. They're all full up. Just thought I'd ask you.
Who was your last master, and why did you leave his service?
Radburn laughed, a friendly sound.
Well, I last sailed with a company of barge ferrymen, taking cargo from ship to shore in the harbour. Been stuck doing that for a year.
He fell silent as the serving wench approached. Amos ordered another round of ale, and when one was set before Radburn, he said,
"Thank you, Captain."
He took a long pull and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"Before I came to be beached, I sailed with Captain John Avery, aboard the Bantamina."
"I know the little rooster, and John Avery, though I haven't seen him since I was last in Durban, 5 or 6 years back."
"Well, I got a little drunk, and the captain told me he'd have none who drank aboard his ship. I drink no more than the next man, Captain, but you know Master Avery's reputation, being an abstentious follower of Sung the White."
Amos looked at Martin and Arutha, but said nothing. Radburn said,
"These your officers, Captain?"
"No, business partners."
When it was clear Amos was going to say nothing more, Radburn let the topic of identities drop. Amos finally said,
"We've been in the city little more than a week, and I've been busy with personal matters. What news?"
Radburn shrugged.
"The war goes on. Good for the merchants, bad for the rest. Now we've the business with Kesh. Before, the troubles was along the far coast, but now, Krondor might not prove such a healthy spot if the Viceroy doesn't chase the dogs of Kesh back home. Otherwise, there's the usual gossip."
He glanced around, as looking for anyone who might overhear.
"And some not so usual."
Amos lifted his mug to his lips, saying nothing.
"Since the Viceroy's come," said Radburn quietly, "things haven't been the same in Krondor. An honest man isn't safe on the streets any more, what with Durban slavers running about and the press gangs almost as bad. That's why I need a ship, Captain."
"Press gangs?"
Amos exploded.
"There hasn't been a press gang in a kingdom city in 30 years.
"Once was, but now things have changed again. You get a little drunk and don't find a safe berth for the night, the press gang comes along and slaps you into the dungeon. It just isn't right, no sir. Just because a man's between ships doesn't give anyone the right to ship him out with Lord Jessop's fleet for 7 years. 7 years of chasing pirates and fighting Quiggan war galleys."
Amos's eyes narrowed.
"How is it that Guy rules in Krondor? We've heard stories, but they seem confused."
Radburn nodded.
"Right you are, Captain, for it is confusing. A month ago, Lord Guy rides in with his army behind, flags are waving, drums beating, and the rest. The prince, so they say, welcomes him and treats him real friendly, even though de Bastyre is carrying the king's writ naming him viceroy. The prince even helps him, they say, until this business of the press gangs and such comes to his ears."
Lowering his voice more, he said,
"I heard that when he complained, Guy locks him up in his rooms. Nice rooms, I expect, but same as a cell if you can't leave. So I hear."
Arutha was so outraged by the story, he was on the verge of speaking. Amos gripped his arm quickly, warning silence, then said,
"Well, Radburn, I can always use a good man who sailed with John Avery. I'll tell you what, I've one more trip to the ship to make tonight, and there are some personal belongings in my room I'll want aboard. Come along and carry them."
Amos rose and, giving the man no time to object, gripped him by the arm and propelled him toward the stairs. Arutha shot a glance at the group who entered with Radburn. They seemed unaware for the moment of what was transpiring across the crowded common room as Amos took Radburn up the stairs, Arutha and Martin following behind. Amos hustled Radburn down the hall and, once through the door to their room, spun and delivered a staggering blow to Radburn's stomach, doubling him over. A brutal knee to the face, and Radburn lay stunned upon the floor.
"What is this all about?" said Arutha.
"That man's a liar. John Avery's a marked man in Kesh. He betrayed the Durban captains to a Kragan raiding fleet 20 years ago. Yet Radburn didn't bat an eye when I said I saw Avery in Durban 6 years ago. And he's too free in showing disrespect to the Viceroy. His story stinks like a weak dead fish. We go out the door with him, and inside of 2 blocks a dozen men or more will be upon us."
"What shall we do?" said Arutha.
"We leave. His friends will be up those stairs in a minute."
He pointed to the window. Martin stood by the door as Arutha ripped aside a dirty canvas shade and pushed open the wooden shutters. Amos said,
"Now you see why I chose this room."
Less than a yard below the window's ledge was the roof of the stable. Arutha stepped out, Amos and Martin following. They hurried carefully down the steeply sloping roof until they reached the edge. Arutha leaped down, landing quietly, followed a moment later by Martin. Amos landed more heavily, but suffered only a minor bruise to his dignity. They heard a cough and an oath, and looked up to see a bloodied face at the window. Radburn shouted,
"They're in the courtyard!"
as the 3 fugitives started for the gate. Amos swore,
"I should have cut his throat!"
They ran to the gate, and as they entered the street, Amos grabbed at Arutha. A group of men were running down the street toward them. Arutha and his companions fled the opposite way, ducking into a dark alley. Hurrying along between the blank walls of 2 buildings, they cut across a busy street, overturning several pushcarts, and ducked into another alley, the cart owner's curses following. They continued to run, the sounds of pursuit never far behind, following a twisting maze of back alleys and side streets through darkened Krondor. Turning a corner, they found themselves intersecting a long, narrow street, little more than an alley, flanked on both sides by tall buildings. Amos rounded the corner first and motioned for Arutha and Martin to halt. In low tones, he said,
"Martin, hurry down to the corner and take a look around. Arutha, go the other way."
He pointed toward a spot where dim light could be seen.
"I'll stand watch here. If we become separated, make for the ship. It'll be a desperate chance breaking the blockade, but should you win free, have Vasco make for Durban. Your gold will buy you enough protection there to get the ship refitted and you back to Crydee. Now go."
Arutha and Martin ran down the street in opposite directions, and Amos stood watch behind. Abruptly, shouts came down the narrow street, and Arutha looked back. At the other end of the street, he could see the dim figure of Martin struggling with several men. He started back, but Amos shouted,
"Go on! I'll help him! Get away!"
Arutha hesitated, then resumed his run toward the distant light. He was panting when he reached the corner and nearly skidded to a halt as he entered a well-traveled, brightly lit avenue. From carts decorated with lanterns, hawkers sold their wares to passing citizens out for a stroll after supper. The weather was mild, there looked to be little chance of snow this winter, and large numbers of people were about. From the condition of the buildings and the fashions of those in the area, Arutha knew he was in a more prosperous section of the city. Arutha stepped into the street and forced himself to walk at a leisurely pace. He turned and made a display of examining a garment seller's wares as several men appeared from the street he had just fled. He tugged a garish red cloak from among the goods and swirled it about his shoulder, pulling the hood over his head.
"Here now, what do you think you're doing?"
asked a dried-faced old man in a reedy whisper. Affecting a nasal voice, Arutha said,
"My good man, you don't expect me to purchase a garment without seeing if it fits?"
Suddenly confronted by a buyer, the man became unctuously friendly.
"Oh, no, certainly, sir."
Looking at Arutha in the ill-tailored cloak, he said,
"It's a perfect fit, sir, and the colour suits you well, if I may say."
Arutha chanced a glance at his pursuers. The man called Radburn stood at the corner, blood dried upon his face and his nose swollen, but still able to direct his men's search. Arutha adjusted the cloak, a great cumbersome thing that hung nearly to the ground. In a display of fussiness, he said,
"You think so? I wouldn't care to appear at court looking like a vagabond." "Oh, court, is it, sir? Well, it's just the thing, mark me. It adds a certain elegance to your appearance." "How much is it?"
Arutha saw Radburn's men walking through the busy crowd, some looking into each tavern and storefront as they passed, others hurrying on to other destinations. More followed from the smaller street, and Radburn spoke quickly to them. He set some to watching those in the street, then turned and led the rest back the way they had come.
"It's the finest cloth made in Rann, sir," said the seller. "It was brought at great expense from the shore of the Kingdom Sea. I couldn't let it go for less than 20 golden sovereigns."
Arutha blanched, and for a moment was so struck by the outrageous price he nearly forgot himself.
20?
He lowered his voice as a passing member of Radburn's company threw him a quick glance.
"My dear man," he said, returning to character, "I seek to purchase a cloak, not establish an annuity for your grandchildren."
Radburn's man turned away and disappeared into the press of the crowd.
"It is rather a plain wrap, after all. I should think 2 sovereigns more than sufficient."
The man looked stricken.
"Sir, you seek to beggar me. I couldn't think of parting with it for a sum of less than 18 sovereigns.
They haggled for another 10 minutes, and Arutha finally departed with a cloak for the price of 8 sovereigns and 2 silver royals. It was double the price he should have paid, but the searchers had ignored a man haggling with a street seller, and escaping detection was worth the price 100 times over. Arutha kept alert for signs he was being watched as he made his way along the street. Unfortunately, he knew little of Krondor and had no idea where he was after the flight. He kept to the busier part of the street, staying close to larger groups, seeking to blend in. Arutha saw a man standing at the corner, seemingly idling the night away, but clearly watching those who passed. Arutha looked around and saw a tavern on the other side of the street, marked by a brightly painted sign of a white dove. He quickly crossed the street, keeping his face turned away from the man at the corner, and approached the doorway of the tavern. As he reached for the door, a hand gripped his cloak, and Arutha spun, his sword halfway out of its scabbard. A boy of about 13 stood there, wearing a simple, oft-patched tunic and men's trousers cut off at the knees. He had dark hair and eyes, and his smudged face was set in a grin.
"Not there, sir," he said with a merry note in his voice.
Arutha slipped his sword back into the scabbard and fell into character.
"Begone, boy. I've no time for beggars or panderers, even those of limited stature."
The boy's grin broadened.
"If you insist, but there are 2 of them in there."
Arutha dropped his nasal accent.
"Who?" "The men who chased you from the side street."
Arutha glanced about. The boy appeared alone. He looked into the boy's eyes and said,
"What are you talking about?"
"I saw how you acted. Quick on your feet, sir. But they've blanketed the area, and you'll not be slipping by them yourself."
Arutha leaned forward.
"Who are you, boy?"
With a toss of his ragged hair, he said,
"Name's Jimmy. I work hereabouts. I can get you out. For a fee, of course."
"And what makes you think I wish to get out?"
"Don't play the fool with me, like you did with the merchant, sir. You need to get clear of somebody who's likely to pay me to show him where you are. I've run afoul of Radburn and his men before, so you have more of my sympathy than he's likely to get, as long as you can bid more for your freedom than he will for your capture. You know Radburn?
Jimmy grinned.
Not so as I'd care to admit, but yes, we've had dealings before.
Arutha was struck by the boy's cool manner, not what he would have expected from the boys he knew back home. Here stood an old hand at negotiating the treacherous byways of the city.
How much?
Radburn will pay me 25 gold to find you. 50, if he especially wants your skin.
Arutha took out his coin pouch and handed it to the boy.
Over 100 sovereigns in there, boy. Get me out of here and to the docks, and I'll double it.
The boy's eyes flickered wide a moment, but he never lost his grin.
You must have offended someone with a lot of influence. Come along.
He darted away so quickly, Arutha almost lost him in the heavy crowd. The boy moved with the ease of experience through the press, while Arutha had to struggle to keep from jostling people in the street. Jimmy led him into an alley, several blocks away. When they were a short way down the alley, Jimmy stopped.
Better toss that cloak. Red's not my favorite color for looking inconspicuous.
When Arutha had pitched the cloak into an empty barrel, Jimmy said,
You'll be pointed at the docks in a moment. If someone tumbles onto us, you're on your own. But for that other 100 gold, I'll try to see you all the way.
They worked their way to the end of the alley, apparently seldom used from the heavy accumulation of trash and discarded objects, packing crates, broken furniture, and nameless goods against the walls around them. Jimmy pulled aside a crate, revealing a hole.
This should put us outside Radburn's net. At least I hope so, said Jimmy.
Arutha found he had to crouch to follow the boy through the small passage. From the rank odor in the tunnel, it was clear something had crawled in here to die fairly recently. As if reading his mind, Jimmy said,
We toss a dead cat in here every few days. Keeps others from sticking their noses too far in.
We?
Said Arutha. Jimmy ignored the question and kept moving. Soon they exited into another alley overburdened with trash. At the mouth of the alley, Jimmy motioned for Arutha to stop and wait. He hurried along the dark street, then returned at a run.
Radburn's men! They must have known you'd head for the harbor.
Can we slip past them?
No chance. They're as thick as lice on a beggar.
The boy took off in the opposite direction down the street they had entered from the alley. Arutha followed as Jimmy turned up another small byway. Arutha hoped he hadn't bargained wrongly in trusting the street boy. After a few minutes of traveling, Jimmy stopped.
I know a place you can hole up a while, until I can find some others to help get you to your ship. But it'll cost you more than 100.
Get me to my ship before dawn, and I'll give you whatever you ask.
Jimmy grinned.
I can ask a lot.
He regarded Arutha for a moment longer, then, with a curt nod of his head, led off. Arutha followed, and they wound their way deeper into the city. The sounds of people in the streets fell off, and Arutha judged they were moving into an area less well travelled at night. The buildings around them showed they were heading into another poor area of the city, though not close to the docks as far as Arutha could tell. Several sharp turns through dark, narrow alleys, and Arutha was completely lost. Abruptly, Jimmy turned and said,
We're there!
He pulled open a door in an otherwise blank wall and stepped through. Arutha climbed a long flight of stairs after him. Jimmy led him down a long hall at the top of the stairs to a door. The boy opened it and indicated Arutha should enter. Arutha took a single step, then halted as he discovered 3 sword points leveled at his stomach. Chapter 7. Escape. A man motioned for Arutha to enter.
He sat behind a small table facing the door. Leaning forward into the light of the small lamp on the table, he said,
"Please come in."
The light revealed his face was covered with pockmarks, and he possessed a large hooked nose. His eyes never strayed from Arutha as the three swordsmen stepped back, allowing the prince entrance. Arutha hesitated as he saw the bound and unconscious forms of Amos and Martin slumped against the wall. Amos groaned and stirred, but Martin remained motionless. Arutha measured the distance between himself and the three swordsmen, his hand hovering near the hilt of his rapier. Any notion of leaping back and drawing his sword vanished when he felt a dagger point pressed against the small of his back. A hand snaked around from behind and relieved him of his sword. Jimmy then stepped around the prince, examining the rapier as he carefully hid his dagger in the folds of his loose tunic. He grinned broadly.
"I've seen a few of these about. It's light enough, I could use it."
Dryly, Arutha said, "Under the circumstances, it might not be inappropriate to make it my legacy to you. Use it in good health." The pock-faced man said,
"You keep your wits about you,"
as Arutha was ushered farther into the room by a swordsman. Another put away his weapon and tied Arutha's arms behind him. He was then roughly thrust into a chair opposite the man who had spoken, who continued,
"My name is Aaron Cook, and you've already met Jimmy the Hand."
He indicated the boy.
"These others prefer to remain anonymous at present."
Arutha looked at the boy.
"Jimmy the Hand?"
The boy executed a fair imitation of a courtly bow, and Cook said,
"The finest pickpocket in Krondor, and well on his way to becoming the finest thief as well, should you be inclined to believe his self-appraisal. Now, to matters of business. Who are you?"
Arutha related the story of being Amos's business partner, calling himself Arthur, and Cook studied him stoically. With a sigh, he nodded, and one of the silent men stepped forward and struck Arutha across the mouth. Arutha's head snapped back from the force of the blow, and his eyes watered.
"Friend Arthur," said Aaron Cook, shaking his head, "we can go about this interview two ways. I'd advise you not to make the choice of the difficult way. It will prove most unpleasant, and we shall know what we want in the end in any event. So please consider your answer carefully."
He stood and came around the table.
"Who are you?"
Arutha began to repeat his story, and the man who struck him stepped forward again, ending his answer with another ringing blow. The man called Cook leaned down so his face was level with Arutha's. Arutha blinked to clear the tears from his eyes, and Cook said,
"Friend, tell us what we ask. Now, so as not to waste time," he pointed at Amos, "that he is the captain of your ship, we concede, but you his business partner?" "I think not. That other fellow played the part of a hunter from the mountains in several taverns about town, and I think it no mummery. He has the look of one who knows mountains better than city streets. A look hard to forge."
He studied Arutha.
"But you are a soldier at least, and your rich boots and fine sword mark you a gentleman. But I think there is more."
Looking into Arutha's eyes, he said,
"Now, why is Jocko Radburn so intent upon finding you?"
Arutha looked Aaron Cook squarely in the eyes.
"I don't know."
The man who had struck Arutha began to step forward again, but Cook held up his hand.
"That may be true. You've been something of a fool, the way you've been popping up here and there, hanging around the gates of the palace, playing the innocent.
You are either poor spies or poor fools, but there is no doubt you've aroused the interest of the Viceroy's men, and therefore ours.
Who are you?
Cook ignored the question.
Jocko Radburn's the senior officer in the Viceroy's secret police. Despite that open, honest face on him, Radburn's one of the most steel-nerved, unmovable bastards the gods ever graced this world with. He'd happily cut his grandmother's heart out if he thought the old girl was making free with state secrets. The fact he put in a personal appearance shows he, at the very least, judges you potentially important. We first learned three men were nosing about town a day or two after you arrived. And when our people heard some of Radburn's men were keeping an eye upon you, we decided to do likewise. When they began offering small bribes for information about you three, we became especially interested. We were content to simply keep watching you, waiting until you showed your hand. But when Jocko and his men showed at the Sailor's Ease, we were forced to act. We snatched those two from under Jocko's nose, but Jocko and his bully boys came down the alley between you and us, so we hurried them away. Jimmy's finding you was a bit of luck, for he didn't know we were ready to bring you in.
He nodded approval to the boy.
You did right bringing him here.
Jimmy laughed. I was on the rooftops, watching the whole thing. I knew you wanted him in as soon as you grabbed the other two.
One of the men swore.
You better not have been trying for a boost without writ from the Nightmaster, boy.
Cook raised his hand, and the man fell silent.
It will not hurt for you to know that some here are mockers, others are not. But we are all united in an undertaking of great importance. Mark me well, Arthur. Your only hope of leaving here alive rests upon our being satisfied you do not endanger that undertaking I spoke of. It may be Radburn's interest in you is only coincidental to his interest in other matters. Or there may be a weaving of threads here, some pattern as yet unseen. In any event, we shall have the truth, and when we are satisfied with what you have told us, we shall set you free. Perhaps even aid you and your companions. Or we shall kill you. Now, start at the beginning. Why did you come to Krondor?
Arutha considered. There was little but pain to be gained by lying. Yet he was not willing to tell the entire truth. That these men were not working with Gee's men wasn't proved. This could be a ploy, with Radburn in the next room listening to every word. He decided what part of the truth to tell.
I'm an agent for Crydee. I came to speak to Prince Erland and Lord Dulanic in person, to ask for aid against a coming Surani offensive. When we learned Guy de Bastyra was in possession of the city, we decided to gauge the temper of things before committing ourselves to a course of action.
Cook listened closely, then said,
Why should an emissary of Crydee slip into the city?
Why not come in with banners flying and receive a state welcome?
Because Black Gear'd just as soon toss him into a cellar's knot, you stupid bastard.
Cook's head snapped around. Amos was sitting up against the wall, groggily shaking his head.
I think you busted my skull, Cook.
Aaron Cook looked hard at Amos.
You know me?
Aye, you wooden-headed sea rat, I know you. I know you well enough to know we're not speaking another word until you go fetch Trevor Hull.
Aaron Cook rose from the table, an uncertain expression on his face. He motioned to one of the men by the door, who also looked discomforted by Amos's words. The man nodded to Cook and left the room. Minutes later he returned, followed by another man, tall, with a shock of grey hair, but still powerful-looking. A ragged scar ran from his forehead through his right eye, which was milky white
and down his cheek. He took a long look at Amos, then laughed aloud and pointed at the captives.
Untie them!
Amos was lifted by two men, then untied. As his ropes were loosened, he said,
I thought they'd hung you years ago, Trevor.
The man clapped Amos on the back.
And are you, Amos?
Cook looked questioningly at the new arrival, while Arutha was untied and Martin revived with a cup of water thrown in his face. The man called Trevor Hull looked at Cook and said,
Have your wits fled, man? He's grown a beard and cut his famous flowing locks, lost some on top and put on a few pounds as well, but he's still Amos Trask.
Cook studied Amos a moment longer, then his eyes widened.
Captain Trenchard?
Amos nodded, and Arutha looked on in astonishment. Even in Far Cryde they had heard of Trenchard the Pirate, the Dagger of the Sea. He'd had a short career, but a famous one. It was reputed even Quiggan war galleys had turned and fled at sight of Trenchard's fleet, and there wasn't a town along the coasts of the Bitter Sea that did not fear his marauders. Aaron Cook extended his hand.
Sorry, Captain. It's been so many years since we last met. We couldn't be certain you weren't part of some plot of Radburn's to locate us.
Who are you? Asked Arutha.
All in good time, answered Hull. Come.
One of the men helped the still groggy Martin to his feet, and Cook and Hull led them to a more comfortable room, with chairs enough for all. When all were sitting, Amos said,
This old rogue is Trevor Hull, Captain Whiteye, Master of the Red Raven.
Hull shook his head sadly.
No longer, Amos. Burned off of Valerial, she was, 3 years ago, by Imperial Keshin cutters. My mate Cook here and a few of my boys got to shore with me, but most of the crew went down with a Red Raven. We made our way back to Durbin, but things are changing, what with the wars and all.
Came to Krondor a year ago and have been working here since.
Working? You, Trevor?
The man smiled, his scar wrinkling, as he said.
Smuggling, in fact. That's what brought us together with the Mockers. Not much can happen in Krondor along those lines without the upright man's permission. When the Viceroy first came to Krondor, we started running up against Jocko Radburn and his secret police. He's been a thorn in our side from the first. This business of guards sneaking about dressed as common folk, there's just no honour in it.
Amos muttered,
I knew I should have cut his throat when I had the chance. Next time I won't be so damn civilised.
Slowing down a bit, Amos? Well, a week ago we got word from the upright man he had a precious cargo to leave the city. We've had to bide our time until the right ship was ready. Radburn's very anxious to find that cargo before it leaves Krondor. So, you see, it's a most delicate situation. For we can't ship it until the blockade's lifted, or we find a blockade captain we can bribe. When we first caught wind you three were asking questions, we thought it might be some grand plot of Jocko's to find that cargo. Now we've cleared the air, I'd like to hear the answer to Cook's question explained. Why should an emissary from Cryde fear discovery by the Viceroy's men?
Listening in, were you?
Amos turned to Arutha, who nodded.
This is no simple emissary, Trevor. Our young friend is Prince Arutha, son of Duke Boric.
Aaron Cook's eyes went wide, and the man who struck Arutha paled. Trevor Hull nodded understanding.
The Viceroy'd pay handsomely to get his hands upon the son of his old enemy, especially when it came time to press his claim in the Congress of Lords.
What claim? Said Arutha.
Hull leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees.
You'd not know, of course. We only heard the news a few days ago ourselves, and it's not common knowledge. Still,
I'm not free to speak plainly without permission.
He rose and left the room. Arutha and Amos exchanged questioning glances. Then Arutha looked toward Martin.
Are you all right?
Martin carefully touched his head.
I'll recover, though they must have hit me with a tree.
One of the men grinned in a friendly, almost apologetic way. Patting a wooden billy in his belt sash, he said,
He's a hard one to bring down, that's for certain.
Hole returned to the room, followed by another. The men in the room rose, and Arutha, Amos, and Martin slowly followed suit. Behind Hull came a young girl no more than 16 years of age. Arutha was instantly struck by the promise of beauty in her features. Large sea-green eyes, straight and delicate nose, and slightly full mouth. A faint hint of freckles dusted her otherwise fair skin. She was tall and slender and walked with poise. She came across the room to Arutha, rose up on tiptoes, and kissed him lightly upon the cheek. Arutha looked surprised at this gesture and watched as she stepped back with a smile upon her lips. She wore a simple dress of dark blue, and her red-brown hair hung loosely to her shoulders. After a second, she said,
Of course. How silly I am. You'd not know me. I saw you when you were last in Krondor, but we never met. I'm your cousin Anita, Erlen's daughter.
Arutha stood thunderstruck. Besides the girl's disquieting effect upon his composure, with her winning smile and clear gaze, he was doubly surprised to find her in this company of brigands. He sat down slowly, and she took a chair. So used to the informality of his father's court, he was somewhat surprised when she gave the others permission to sit.
How?
Arutha began. Amos interrupted.
The upright man's precious cargo?
Hull nodded, and the princess spoke. Her pretty face clouded with emotion.
When the Duke of Bastyra came with orders from the king, Father greeted him warmly and offered no resistance. At first, Father did all he could to aid him in taking command of the army, but when he heard of the things Guy was doing with his secret police and press gangs, Father protested. Then, when Lord Barry died and Guy put Lord Jessop in command of the fleet over Father's objections, and Lord Dulanic disappeared so mysteriously, Father sent a letter to the king, demanding Guy's recall. Guy intercepted the message and ordered us kept under guard in a wing of the palace. Then Guy came to my room one night.
She shuddered. Arutha nearly spat when he said,
You don't have to speak of such things.
The sudden rage startled the girl.
No, she said. It was nothing like that. He was very proper. Nearly formal. He simply informed me we were to be wed, and that King Roderick was to name him heir to the throne of Krondor. If anything, he seemed irritated by the bother of having to take such a course.
Arutha slammed his fist against the wall behind.
That tears it! Guy means to have Erland's crown and Roderick's after. He means to be king!
Anita looked at Arutha shyly.
So it seems. Father's not well, and couldn't resist, though he refused to sign the proclamation of betrothal. Guy had him taken to the dungeon until he would sign.
Her eyes teared as she said,
Father cannot live long in such cold and damp quarters. I fear he will die before agreeing to Guy's wishes.
She continued to speak, her face a mask of control, though tears ran down her cheeks as she talked of her mother and father's imprisonment.
Then one of my ladies told me a maid knew some people in the city who might be willing to help.
Trevor Hull said,
With your permission, Highness, one of the girls in the palace is sister to a mocker. With everything up in the wind, the upright man decided it might be to his advantage to take a hand.
He arranged to smuggle the princess out of the palace the night of Guy's departure, and she's been here since, Amos said.
Then the rumour we overheard before we fled the Sailor's Ease about there being a hunt on for a royal cousin was about Anita, not Arutha.
Hull pointed at the prince.
It may be Radburn and his boys still have no idea who you are. Most likely they jumped on you in the hope you'd turn out to be party to the princess's escape. We're almost certain the Viceroy has no idea she's gone from the palace, for she fled after he rode out. I expect Radburn is desperate to get her back before his master returns from the war with Kesh.
Arutha studied the princess, feeling a strong desire to do something on her behalf, a desire beyond the consideration of foiling Guy. He shunted aside the strange tug of emotions. He asked Trevor Hull,
Why does the upright man wish to contend with Guy? Why isn't he turning her in for a reward?
Trevor Hull looked to Jimmy the Hand, who answered with a grin.
My master, a most perceptive man, saw at once his own interests were best served by aiding the princess. Since Erland has been Prince of Krondor, the business of the city runs smoothly, an environment conducive to the success of my master's many undertakings. Stability profits us all, you see. With Guy here, we've his secret police about, upsetting the normal commerce of our guild. And whatever else, we are most loyal subjects of His Highness, the Prince of Krondor. If he does not wish his daughter to marry the Viceroy, we do not wish it as well.
With a laugh, Jimmy added,
Besides, the princess has agreed to pay 25,000 gold sovereigns to our master, should the guild get her free of Krondor, to be delivered when her father returns to power, or some other fate places her upon the throne.
Arutha took Anita's hand and said,
Well, cousin, there is nothing else to be done. We must take you to Crydy at the first chance.
Anita smiled, and Arutha found himself smiling back. Trevor Hull said,
As I said before, we were waiting for the right opportunity to smuggle her from the city.
He turned to Amos.
You're the man for this, Amos. There's no better blockade runner on the Bitter Sea. Excepting myself, of course. But I've other matters to take care of here.
Trask said,
We can't leave for a few weeks yet. Even if the blockade was lifted, my ship's in desperate need of refitting. And if we left now, we'd have to sail about until the weather in the straits breaks. With Jessop's fleet at sea ambush, that would be risky. I'd rather hide here a while. Then a quick run west, through the straits, and up the far coast with no delay.
Hull slapped him on the shoulder.
Good. That will give us time. I've heard of your ship. The boys tell me it's little better than a barge. We'll find you another. I'll send word to your men when the time is right. Radburn'll most likely leave your crew alone, hoping you'll turn up. We'll slip them aboard the new ship a few at a time at night and replace them with my own boys, so Radburn's men won't notice anything unusual aboard.
He turned to Arutha.
You'll be safe enough here, Highness. This building is one of many owned by the Mockers, and none will get close without our having ample warning. When the time is right, we'll get you all free of the city. Now we'll take you to your room, so you may rest.
Arutha, Martin, and Amos were shown to a room down the hall from the one where they had met Anita, while the princess returned to her own quarters. The room they entered was a simple affair, but clean. All three men were tired. Martin fell heavily on one pallet and was quickly asleep. Amos lowered himself slowly, and Arutha watched him for a moment. With a slight smile, he said,
When you first came to Crydy, I thought you a pirate.
Struggling to remove a boot, Amos said,
In truth, I try to leave that behind me, Highness.
He laughed.
Perhaps it was the gods working their revenge upon me. But you know, for 15 years, man and boy, I was a corsair and a captain. Then when I try my hand at honest trading for the first time, my ship is captured and burned, my crew slaughtered, and I find myself beached as far from the heart of the kingdom as you can get and still be in it.
Arutha lay down upon his pallet. You've been a good counsellor, Amos Trask, and a brave companion. Your help over the years has earned you a good deal of forgiveness for past wrongdoings, but... He shook his head.
Trenchard the pirate! God's man! There's so much to forgive.
Amos yawned and stretched.
When we return to Crydee, you can hang me, Arutha. But for now, please have the good grace to keep silent and put out the light. I am getting too old for this foolishness. I need some sleep.
Arutha reached over and covered the wick of the lamp with a snuff. He lay back in the darkness, images and thoughts crowding his mind. He thought of his father and what he would do were he here, then wondered how his brother and sister were. Thoughts of Carleen caused him to think of Roland, and to speculate how the fortifications of Jonril were progressing. He forced aside the buzzing thoughts and let his mind drift. Then, before sleep took him, he remembered Anita, as she rose up on tiptoes to kiss his cheek, and felt again a not entirely comfortable churning within. A faint smile crossed his lips as he fell asleep. Anita clapped appreciatively as Arutha turned aside the point of Jimmy's sword. The boy thief blushed at his awkwardness, but Arutha said, "That was better." He and Jimmy were practicing basic sword work, Jimmy using a rapier purchased with some of the gold Arutha had given him. For a month they had passed the time this way, and Anita had taken to watching. Whenever the princess was around, the usually brash Jimmy the Hand became subdued, and he blushed furiously whenever she spoke to him. Arutha was now certain the boy thief was afflicted by the worst sort of infatuation for the princess, only 3 years older than himself. Arutha appreciated Jimmy's distress, for he also found the girl's presence a distraction. Still, in the first years of womanhood, she nevertheless carried herself with court-bred grace, had wit and education, and showed the promise of mature beauty. Arutha found it easier to turn his thoughts to other topics than the princess. The basement where they worked on their swordplay was damp and poorly ventilated, so it soon became close and humid. Arutha said, "That's enough for today, Jimmy. You're still impatient to close, and that can be fatal. You've plenty of speed, and it's good you learn young, but you lack arm strength to bash about, as many older men do. With the rapier, that can also prove fatal. Remember, the edge is for cutting, and the point is for killing," finished Jimmy, with a self-conscious grin. "I can see how you'd have to be cautious against a man with a broadsword. He could break your blade if you tried to block instead of parry. But what do you do if one of those alien warriors comes at you with that great sword you described?" Arutha laughed. "You find out who can run faster." Anita's laughter joined with Arutha's and Jimmy's. Arutha said, "Seriously, you must stay to the offhand side. With the big swords, your opponent gets one swing. Then you've got an opening." The door opened, and Amos walked in with Martin and Trevor Hull. Amos said,
"The worst damn luck, begging the princess's pardon. Arutha, the worst has occurred."
Arutha wiped the perspiration off his brow with a towel and said,
"Don't stand there waiting for me to guess. What?" "News came this morning," said Hull. "Guy is returning to Krondor."
"Why?"
asked Anita. Amos said,
It seems our Lord of Bas Tyra rode into Shamata and ran his banner up above the walls. The Keshian commander had the good grace to mount one more attack. For the sake of form, then nearly gave himself a ruptured gut racing back home. He left a handful of minor nobles haggling with Guy's lieutenants over the conditions of armistice, until a formal treaty can be drawn up between the king and the Keshian empress. There's only one reason Guy can be hurrying back here.
Quietly, Anita said, "He knows I've escaped." Trevor Hull said,
"Yes, Highness, this Black Guy's a wily one. He must have a spy in Radburn's company. It appears he doesn't even trust his own secret police over much. Luckily, we still have people inside the palace loyal to your father, or we would never have learned of this turn."
Arutha sat down near the princess.
"Well, then we must soon be gone. It's either sail for home or toward Yalith to reach father."
Amos said,
"Looking at the choices, it seems there is little to recommend one course over the other. Both have dangers and advantages."
Martin looked at the girl, then said,
"Though I don't think the Duke's war camp any place for a young woman."
Amos sat down by Arutha.